board, ladies and gentlemen, and everyone with an open mind, but not so open that your brain has fallen out. That's what we love about you guys and gals. Your fearless attitude and interest in discussions that are concerning, in some cases, the most difficult and challenging topics of our time. This is Red Ice Radio. Thank you so much for being here. This is a program for those who dare to question the official stories, to clarify those who dare to go anywhere in order to find out and dispel the mythmakers that have invented stories in order to use history against you and hide the truth among an endless string of lies. Our website is redicecreations.com, and this is an independent program that does intrepid investigations into all the things that we consider it to be important and, of course, interesting to know more about in order to get to the bottom of things and not settle for the Hollywood version of history. I have a couple of things I want to mention before we get to our guest here, because I know that more and more topics and subjects, unfortunately, are becoming what more and more people deem to be offensive and off-limits. This is done so that the material that is forbidden to talk about can be used against you. That's right, so that what we don't find out and what we can't examine and research can be used to manipulate us. Let me explain. This is done in such a way so that if we don't know anything about it, or if we don't know what really happened, it will remain an unknown variable shrouded in mystery, and we will never, ever know, and we'll never, ever be able to make the right decisions based on the true chain of events and the outcome of what really happened. Worse, of course, is if we get the entire story wrong, and the more of an impact the event in question has on world history, the more important it is to know, study, and learn as much as we can about it. Nonetheless, I would still argue that if there is one preeminent taboo in this world, then it is the one we're going to discuss today. It's even been such a no-no that, in fact, even much of the so-called alternative truth-seeking media have avoided it, and a lot of channels to this day continue to repeat what they have heard on the History Channel in Hollywood movies and the politically correct and socially engineered textbooks that our children get indoctrinated with year after year after year for control purposes. Adolf Hitler. Who was he? What was his goals? Did he want to conquer the world? Did he want to create a new world order? Did he want to exterminate all Jews? If so, why? How come Germany rose to the military power that it did in such a short time? How was it funded? Why did all the things that happened during the Second World War occur in the first place? And even more importantly, did they occur as we've been told? Is there a Germanic death cult that controls the world today? And is it just a matter of time before the hidden Nazis of this world are in full control of it? Or is there another force in control? A force that actually won the Second World War? Well, these are just a few of the questions that we'll attempt to answer with our guest today, Dennis Wise from the UK, who is behind the very well-made, excellent and moving documentary called Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. I want you to do something for me as well, and I would really appreciate it. Before you listen to this interview, I want you to watch the documentary. I know you want to listen to this program right away, but if you haven't already seen it, I want you to stop this program right now and go watch the documentary first. Now, I'm serious. I know it's a long documentary film, but folks, this interview is available in our archives, and you can listen to it whenever you want. So go to thegreateststorynevertold.tv, thegreateststorynevertold.tv, or just click the link from our program page here for Dennis Wise and watch his film, Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. I think you'll find our discussion here today more valuable and engaging because as you watch the film, you have a lot of questions that come up along the way. And we're going to try to ask some of these and answer some of these as well during this interview. And I'm adamant about watching the documentary because one of the biggest hurdles that the majority of people seem to have is that they're too angry. They're in some cases too afraid. They're too emotionally invested, or they're basically just kind of set in their ways, and they argue that they already know everything that they need to know concerning this topic. Well, I can promise you, people, you don't know one-tenth of it. And it's just a fascinating story as well, folks. And I think that you deserve to know the other side to the story. So stop this program right now and go watch the documentary. And welcome back. Thank you for joining us here. Again, we either welcome you back or you stayed with us here because you've already seen the film. But if you did take the time to watch it, I want to thank you for doing that, for taking the time. I think you're glad that you did, and I expect you to be pretty blown away right now if you're an honest truth seeker who haven't seen any of this kind of material before, especially when you realize how much you didn't know and how much has been kept from you and hidden from you about this historical event. It's pretty remarkable, isn't it? Now, our guest, Dennis Weiss, is an independent filmmaker with a successful background in entertainment and media. He began video editing after discovering he had a flair for producing groundbreaking and exciting promotional videos for clients in the entertainment and leisure industry. Apart from researching and producing documentaries, today he still produces private videos for clients such as internationally recognized hotel chains, as well as in the music industry. All right, here we go. And welcome, Dennis Weiss. Thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure speaking with you, sir. Hope you're doing well today.
I'm doing fine. Thank you. It's a pleasure, as always, to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, first of all, just great job on the documentary, Dennis. It's very well made. I want to, first of all, just, well, thank you for making it and for giving people an opportunity to actually get an ounce of objectivity and some kind of, you know, honest material on what indeed is, you know, the greatest story never told. So thank you for making it, Dennis.
Well, let me thank you, because not everybody looks at it that way. Hopefully the more people that view it will understand exactly the angle I'm coming from, and that is honesty and truth.
Well, exactly. I mean, there are just so many of the issues that we can and need to tackle in this program, and this is so important. It's also a delicate question, of course. Maybe not for some, but for others, maybe more so and even intensely so emotionally and psychologically. It's an important issue, I feel, to do it in such a way so that people actually are in a position where they can hear the story from an objective point of view, because those who have the brain and those who are smart enough and realize why this topic is important, they are all, you know, human beings that deserve to know the truth, especially if it's, you know, people who have lost family during the First and especially then during the Second World War. People just kind of want to know. But the first thing I'd like to have people understand is when you approach this topic and when you do so, and what you do, what you have done, Dennis, you come up against a wall of over 60 years intense propaganda and lies, endless barrages of you know, History Channel documentaries and a seemingly endless flow of repetitions from people who have not, and I repeat, have not come from a position where they are attempting to objectively look at history and the events surrounding World War II and the build-up to the war and Hitler himself. They are, in fact, I believe, setting out to, I would say in most cases, not only prove how, you know, kind of evil Hitler were and the National Socialists were, but to emphasize, to strengthen it, to kind of reinforce and perhaps even find more wicked, occult, you know, supernatural and magical explanations for the out-of-this-world, you know, satanic and demonic actions that the most evil person ever lived have exhibited, you know. So the question is, how do you approach this subject? How do you even begin to taking it on without having the knee-jerk, mind-controlled, I would say, responses to kick in, something that have been programmed into people not only by the propaganda of the victors, the allies, and the communists after the war, as we know, but also from the army of Hollywood propagandists that year after year write the same stories for the consumption of those who have not been given a chance to know what really happened and why. You know, it's kind of this position that we know this now. This is an established fact, right? And why would so many people lie about this for such a long time? These are very difficult questions, you know. But to kind of begin to ease into this a little bit here, then, Adolf Hitler, the most evil man ever lived, right? People not only need this to be true, there is an entire mythology, and I would say at this point, Dennis, a religion actually that has been built up around this. This is on par, I would say, with questioning the validity of of Christ to a Christian or Muhammad to a Muslim, or in this case, questioning Hitler to, you know, for a Jew or a religiously indoctrinated, you know, communist, the person on the left or whatnot. But maybe a good place to start is when you first developed and even a desire to look at the story objectively, Dennis. Why did you want to look at this when all the facts are already known, right? What happened there?
Well, it started way back when I was a child. I came home from school, and my father, who had fought for the Axis powers down in the Balkans, obviously on the side of Germany, I questioned him over a classroom lesson that I'd received about how evil Adolf Hitler was. When I questioned him, he obviously thought it was time for me to be sat down and be told the truth, what he believed to be the truth. This was roughly probably 10, 12 years of age. And since that time, living over here in the UK, where the name Adolf Hitler is just completely taboo, I had to keep all this to myself and stay quiet over a number of years, into my teens and later on. It was only till the internet became available and I had certain skills, I felt, with making videos, although at that point probably the longest video I'd made was about 5 minutes in promotion terms. I had a decision, a personal decision for myself to make. I thought, do I tell the world about this story? And we've always gone along with the line, you watch, you decide. It's not like I'm pushing it on anybody.
No.
I decided to go ahead with it, not thinking it would be 6.5 hours. More, I was thinking more maybe an hour, maybe an hour and a half. But the deeper I researched into it, and I was getting confirmation from what my father had told me, and that did give me an advantage, starting from that base that Hitler was not the bad guy, which then took me down a road which other people researching would probably not have gone down. And there were one or two things that I knew what to look out for. For instance, I knew at the age of 12 about the Blueberg Massacre, the biggest massacre in Central Europe, which took place after the war. And was never spoken about and never acknowledged in the history books. So I did have a slight advantage coming from that point of view. And the more and more I researched and things were turning up, it got to a point where I could practically predict what would happen, even though I had to, you know, in the end of it, I had to source it all, but I could practically predict it because I could see how things were working out. What did amaze me is once the YouTube page started going up and there was every chance of being taken down at any second, was the reaction I was getting from people who was viewing them. And without a doubt, it was what made it so special was it was breaking down barriers which no other documentary I felt had ever done before. For some reason, people view the documentary and they just some are absolutely shell shocked.
Yeah,
And that's exactly what the documentary was meant to do. And what can I say? It's done its job.
Well, exactly. 6.5 hours. There's what, 27 parts now, I believe, something like that.
Yeah, there's a bonus part. Yeah,
that's right. A couple of extra ones. Well, I mean, these are just remarkable claims. You know, Hitler was not the bad guy. I feel, you know, might be itching, you know, some people's head at this stage. You know, yeah. So. What material is, we can just maybe talk about that first a little bit, the material that's out there and how to be, even begin to look at this objectively, just as when I said before, there's just a barrage of what I feel is allied, you know, propaganda and reinventions and mythologies that are, you know, constructed afterwards. But where did you begin to look to get some kind of objective, except, of course, as you said, you were questioning people who actually were involved and knew a bit more personally about the issue, but book-wise, research-wise?
Well, without the internet, it couldn't be possible at all. But because of the internet, with YouTube and various other websites, you know, it is. If you know what you're looking for, then you know it is a bit of digging, maybe, but you can find it. Everything in that documentary is all out there, but it was a bit like scattered. It wasn't put together in any way or form. So that was the intention. And when you say where to start, I actually found it quite easy to start because over here and I presume in America and the rest of Europe, even though Hitler won five or six medals, and one was a Iron Cross first class, another one second class, everything that Hitler ever did was demeaned. People said he wasn't a warrior, or he had a cushy job in the army, etc. And these were just ridiculous statements, which, it's where I started. I mean, if somebody wins the Iron Cross, to me and everybody else in a sensible world, is a war hero.
Right. Well, you focused also a lot of, obviously, on the personal journey of Adolf Hitler, that he was, a genuine man who had real sentiments and just tried to tackle this approach that the design before any of this even happened was that they had a desire to build the greatest mass murdering machine ever possible. I mean, this is really some of the arguments that we're hearing out there at the stage here, but there's so many, myths and also conspiracies around this and things that have been kind of invented, I feel, to make things fall into place in the right way here. But maybe we can just talk a little bit about how you see the journey of Hitler, what some of the reasonings were and why, how he developed from the man he was during the First World War, being part of the military there, into coming to the position that he did of Chancellor, Reich Chancellor, and being a very adamant speaker and everything else. What kind of journey did he go through, the man?
Well, obviously, he said many times in his speeches, I am one of you. He came from the working class. He knew what hunger was. He had actually been in a position of poverty himself. So he knew, for example, what it was like to be hungry. And he also knew what it was like to work all hours under the sun, but not yet afford to be able to go on holiday, like many people today. And it's such an existence, a poor existence, that he could associate with this. And his message got through to eventually millions and millions of voters in Germany, because at the end of the day, he was voted in democratically and won that election. But what really, I think, inspired him was the fact that after he'd been in the war, he found his purpose, he came out, and he saw the state of Germany and how they'd been treated after the Treaty of Versailles, which, I mean, it's common knowledge, was an awful treaty. Even the most ardent of people would agree. But this was like for 20 years now, pain and suffering on Germany. And if you look at every single action what Adolf Hitler said or did, then without doubt it was the breaking of that Treaty of Versailles. That was his uppermost in his mind. And eventually, got to Poland, and different reasons are given by different quarters of why that war started. But up to that point, there was never no intention to conquer the world, as a lot of people say. But it was more nationalism, more getting his own country in ship shape, which he did in a record number of years. When he first got elected, he said, "Give us 4 years," and he practically saw the unemployment of 6 or 7 million in less than 2 years. So everything he was doing was to improve the life of the German family. We can talk about things later on how people say different, but there's no denying that his utmost goal was to break that Treaty of Versailles.
Well, exactly. And I want people to understand as well that there is this kind of notion out there that people who were supportive of the man and this party at the time, that, oh my God, they had to be psychotic, right? There was some kind of mass mind control going on. There was something that was so mysterious of how so many people could be supportive. I mean, I think a big hurdle to this, Dennis, is the fact that people, they believe that people have to, they would be forced to time travel into our time to learn what we've learned about it today, to be in a position even where their actions would have seemed psychotic or that they were somehow evil and wicked people. What I'm getting at is that if he managed to genuinely turn around Germany, and we can talk about those conditions that existed after the Versailles Treaty and the concerted, as I say, the concerted efforts by all the other countries blaming Germany and trying to basically destroy it after the First World War, if he managed to turn this around, if he genuinely managed to do this and create the economic miracle that we hear that he actually did, then it's very logical that a majority of people in Germany would be in support of this. They would literally have seen their own lives improve and turn out for the better due to the politics that he put on the country, right?
Well, one of the more famous revisionists, who I won't mention, after he'd seen the documentary, said to another person that the footage, what's been revealed in this documentary, is just wouldn't have been possible, shouldn't have been possible. But I have my ways and means of finding it. And to see what you're calling, or what the West would call a psychotic Germany supporting Hitler, if you see the faces of them Germans coming out in the droves to greet Adolf Hitler with genuine smiles on their face,
yeah,
this is something you can't act, you can't hide. You know, it's there for all to see. And a lot of the footage does show this, and that has a big effect on people watching it, because there is no denying it. There's an awesome love for this guy, and there would be. Who wouldn't love a guy who took you out of poverty and put you into a place now where your family's secure, you know you've got bread on your table, and your wages are solid, and everything's fine. You would adore this guy.
Yeah, a lot of the kind of the Freudians out there try to kind of turn this into some evidence that there's some kind of was a mass psychosis going on, and again I just refer to that when you approach the subject and when you go into it, try to put aside today what you know. I mean, laid out on the timeline, and so when you look at footage of what happened there and everything else before the war, don't have in mind what you've been told what happened. You know, what really happened during the war, after the war, in other words, the time that we are in now, in that timeline, try to just look at it, what actually happened there, and then maybe, and try to reason, explain to it from there, because people have this idea, of course, of even, like, you know, guilt by association, etc. They have they show, for example, some people out there in the conspiracy world and the alternative media as well, they show, for example, an image with where Hitler is shaking hands with you know, the British, you know, king or other statesmen and stuff like that, and they're like, look, it's kind of proof, you know, that they're all Nazis and they were in on it together, right? I mean, he was an admired person. That's why he ended up on the Time magazine cover. He was a great statesman, and whoever would not meet the man and put in a political meeting, that would be not a smart move at the time, correct?
Exactly. He got praise from all around Europe for what he did for Germany. You don't got to know that Germany was down on its knees. Germany was probably 2 years of just going completely bankrupt and into total demise. I mean, there was like 100,000 people committing suicide, you know, the year before Hitler came to power. It's crazy that just people don't understand just the depths of despair that Germany was in. And that was kind of orchestrated, and Hitler has to do certain things when he came to power. Not everybody likes it, but he has to do certain things, and what he did certainly worked.
What kind of world was it before that time? Maybe we can just talk about that a little bit. You had a part, one of the parts were kind of about, you know, Berlin at the time specifically, and then kind of the other, sorry, I forget the town right now, but where the National Socialist Party kind of came out of. What town was that again?
Munich,
exactly. Thank you. And you had a kind of a world in Berlin that was it was filled with, you know, debauchery, promiscuity, prostitution. It was kind of a cesspool of immorality, really, and all the things with, you know, with drugs and everything else. And it was that was something that was kind of spread all over Germany. Now, do you believe that was a tactic to break down the German people? Where did all these influences come from, Dennis, and why did this kind of center in Berlin?
Well, I think it's a tactic what's going on today. Certainly in Berlin at the time, as you said, Berlin was a center of debauchery in Europe. People would come from all over Europe because it was so, you know, I mean, it was so cheap. I mean, ten American dollars could buy anything, anything in the perverted sex world. Paedophilia, child prostitution, bestiality, you name it, that's Berlin was the center of it all. Homosexuality was a haven, and all this was, like you say, Munich was more of a national socialist, right-wing type of center, where Berlin was left-wing and more communist. And certainly Hitler said, as soon as you come to power, what goes on in Berlin, I will stop. And he did, and this kind of drove a lot of people out, mainly the Jewish, you know, people at the nightclub owners, etc., and actors and actresses who left for America. And if you're going to have any comparison today, then I suppose Hollywood is the place you'd compare it to, where Satanism, drugs, prostitution, debauchery goes on in that place. And Hitler was against all that and cleaned up Berlin and eventually cleaned up Germany to a point where families could then walk the streets of Berlin. It was before it wasn't safe. Now, these are not actions of an evil man. This is a man who loves his country and loves the people in his country.
It was kind of like our times to Sodom and Gomorrah kind of thing. Women and children had to sell their bodies to survive. In some cases, there was a desire then to clean this up, and this was done with a pretty firm and strong and ferocious hand, right?
Yeah, I think it needed to be, because these people won't be happy to start with the fact that they've been told that they can't do it no more, like the pimps, etc. But in the end, he sorted it, and if that is an evil man, then I'll have you the case.
So let's look at the book burning and stuff like that. What kind of literature was it that was burned? Things that were outlawed, things that wasn't approved. This is obviously, we're kind of jumping a little bit in the timeline, but that's fine, back and forth when they came into power, what happened and whatnot. But what kind of things were not approved, if you look at it?
Well, we're not actually told just what we're being burned. What we're actually told is that, look at these National Socialists burning a culture. That's not telling the truth, the whole truth. What the National Socialists were burning were books on pornography, books on communism, such writings as Lenin and etc., which Hitler didn't feel was in any way part of German culture anyway. So again, was this an evil moment when they're burning such pornography and what he believed to be a political enemy of his nation?
Yeah, I definitely want to talk more about communism later and the threat that they considered that this posed, not only to Germany, but to Europe and eventually the world as well, and much more of that nature. But let's just tackle the economic thing a little bit more here, because a lot of people have looked at this from different angles. They've tried, basically, by any means necessary, we must prove that he was not only a fraud, but he was like, he couldn't possibly have pulled this off himself. Obviously, we know that there were more people in the party. There was other people there that were helping him. It's not all on him, but he was the leader of this, right? So we've heard arguments that Hitler got his money from Wall Street. You have the research of someone like Anthony C. Sutton, for example, who wrote Rise of Hitler and Wall Street, or if it's Wall Street and Rise of Hitler. What happened there? How did he manage to turn it around economically, and where did the money come from, Dennis?
Well, I have no doubt at all that there were some American industrialists like the Ford Motor Company who did financially aid Hitler, and some others as well. But that was really because they were just as frightened as communism as what Hitler was for Germany. They were the last people who wanted communism to take over. And certainly my research took me to a point where I think the Ford company used to give him $50,000 on every birthday. So there's no denying that, I think, money was raised as much as possible. But one has to always remember at that time when he first, he was a 55th member of the National Socialist Party, and there were 6 million communists in Germany at that time. So he's, they're way outnumbered. and an incredible job to swing things around. So, yes, he must have accepted money from some point. I accept that. But his overall goal was to clean up Germany, bring him out of that recession. And as we found later on, a country which was like 50, 75 years ahead of the world on inventions, etc. Was just unbelievable.
Well, exactly. It's extraordinary what some of the things that did occur in there within the system, and also when there is a concerted effort, I believe, then of the politicians of the system in place that actually is for the people and an encouragement of their development, a betterment of them, if you will. But just to reemphasize what you mentioned there, I think what you're getting to as well is kind of the same nature that try to forget everything you today know about the event and instead focus on the time of what happened. And we're, right now, we don't know the future. We're like in 1934, '35, '36, something like that, right now. And we're looking at it, trying to look at it objectively. And a realization you come to is, of course, that during an economic miracle like this and when it begins to turn around, you would have a lot of investment in the country, correct? You would have actually a lot of people going in with capital, even supporting it in some cases. Or was it? Is it true that he had he completely severed himself from the international banking system and he just took care of the economy from within the country, Dennis? Or was there still, trade and things like that, export import with other countries at the time?
Well, the problem was as soon as Hitler came to power in 1933. There's obviously evidence in the documentary which shows it, that the international jury declared war on Germany, much the same as a sanction on Iraq or Iran or Russia at the moment.
Yes.
The point was, like, sanctions were put onto Germany, which didn't make his job any easier. But even with all that on top, he got the economy going. And one of the ways that he got the economy going was, as you say, he removed certain bankers from the system, and he removed usury from the system, which he always felt was abhorrent. And as I do, I'm sure many other people. So by replacing certain elements of that finance machine, if you like, and the government taking over more and more, and the implements of what he, such, for instance, like creation of jobs, which was unbelievable. I mean, like 6-7 million. Unemployed when he came in, and after 2 or 3 years, it cleared it up simply by building motorways, for instance, where he'd have motorways running the stretch of the country. He'd have certain workplaces where men could go and work. They'd stop all week and then they'd go home at the weekend, money in their pockets. The wives would take the money off and gladly go out, buy a dress, buy shoes, buy clothes, food, whatever, and the economy got going. And quite simply, without this kind of a shadow of usury and debt over the top of you, things started to pick up. And within three or four years, by 1936, he was hosting the Olympics and probably the most happy, buoyant country in the world, because it's got to remember, the rest of the world is in recession from America. And the big myth is that Hitler needed a war to get that recession going. Quite opposite. America needed that war to get that recession rid of.
Interesting, very interesting. Now, exactly, think about that, people. If the story is correct, if we look at this objectively, what we're being told here is that he is one who actually broke out of the type of monetary banking system that the world has suffered under for so many years now, and everything that happened with the collapse and the consolidation of more and more wealth into fewer hands, etc. This is actually someone who tried to break out of that. And this is, of course, rightly to say, when we get the when Judea declares war on Germany there in 1933, the Jewish boycott of German goods, etc. There was rallies to boycott Nazi Germany at the, held at Madison Square Garden, and it was sponsored by the American Jewish Congress and the Jewish Labor Committee, and a lot of people were involved in this and whatnot. So there was a trade war going on at this place, basically.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah. Without a doubt. And it got to a point where Germany had to barter to to keep their heads above water, whereas, you know, what sense they had, they would barter with another country to what their needs were. Somewhat similar to what Venezuela did, are still doing today, I believe.
Right, right, exactly. Now, the job creation, was all of this to build up the war industry? Because I know that after the First World War, there was a limit imposed on Germany of, for example, how many troops they could have, active, you know, troop members, and their military was decimated or, you know, almost into non-existence. I wonder what time that, if that was, that restriction was taken off at some point, and was it when Hitler started building this up, was it a build-up already in the early 30s towards the war industry and building, like, you know, weaponry and everything else, or what happened there?
Well, in my opinion, after that per se treaty, one of the most ridiculous parts is that Germany was only allowed an army of 100,000, no air force and no navy.
Yeah.
At that time, people got to realise that communism is rife in Europe and is pressing to spread, because communism is what communism is. It believes in world taking over the world. So at that time, not having an army big enough to defend the city, never mind the country, was ridiculous. And if anybody's going to make heads or tails of him building an army, then the first thing he has to do, especially with somebody like Stalin quite close, is to build up his armed force, if not for anything else, but for the defence of his nation, and which is exactly what he did. But not only did he build an army up and a navy and an air force, he built one of the greatest ever seen, which again was incredible.
Yeah, exactly. Now, let's just tackle some of the other myths along the way here as we go, Dennis. But what I've heard other stories then that, you know, Hitler was basically, he was in on it. He was a, you know, Rothschild agent. His mom was really a Rothschild. There were things along the way here that occurred that, yes, he was actually intent on helping to destroy Germany by bringing them into a war. There's a number of versions of variations here. Again, I think this stems from an idea that it's an impossibility to just assume that he was genuine, right? So we need to kind of reach for any other explanation we can to wrap our head around the mythology that we've been given afterwards. So I think that that's something that occurs, that when you get the false story and you try to fit reality into that false story, you have to start changing the objectives to make it to have it make sense, right? But what would you say concerning those rumors and conspiracies, Dennis?
Well, again, all through this documentary, all I can say to you is that I've always said that actions speak louder than words. So it doesn't matter what anybody says and what anybody proposed to believe to have been done. The fact is, the actions taken, and the actions that Hitler took, as I said a little bit earlier, was up to this point was to break the Versailles Treaty. Everything he did was to break that demonic treaty. As far as the Rothschilds go, he's the only person ever to have jailed a Rothschild. When he entered Austria, I can't remember which Rothschild it was, he actually put him in jail and they actually ransomed him out at the end of it all. So where they're getting this thing about the Rothschild thing, it's misinformation. It's similar to the occult thing that you mentioned early on, which I'm sure we'll discuss a little bit later. But all his actions speak louder than any words that I can speak.
I'm sure that that went down real well with the Rothschilds. I'm sure that they, at that point, said, oh, this is a great man. Let's support this gentleman, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man.
Up to this point, you've got him changing the banking system. You've got him abolishing usury, and you've got him, once the Anschluss comes along, he arrests the Rothschild. What does that tell you?
Yeah, it tells you he's in deep doo-doo in the rest of the world, or those who are seeking to rule the world. With an iron fist, they're going to turn against Germany at that point, right?
Exactly. He's certainly not one of them.
So what about the Reichstag fire a little bit? Let's talk about that. It was also rumors that it was a false flag. He did this to, you know, gain credibility and power and whatnot. What have you found out about that?
Well, there's a lot of stories around the Reichstag, just as there is about gun control, because there's a lot of misinformation about the gun control. Most people think that Hitler was the one who took the guns off people, like, and that again is false, and it's stated in Mein Kampf. So about the Reichstag, people can assume, that's all they can do, they can assume that it was a false flag. But there's an argument on the other side which is more than worthy, and that's the point, is that for many, many years, a lot of communists in America, sorry, in Germany, looked at Hitler as a complete joke. He never thought he'd ever get in power. Suddenly, he's been swept to power, he's in control, and these communists now have got a problem. So, 6 million reasons why frustration, anger, hatred, that Reichstag could have gone up in flames.
Right.
There's no evidence either way, but surely after the incident happened, Hitler brought in measures, certain measures, to make sure that it wasn't going to happen again.
Yeah, I think people are at a loss to try to explain or realize the situation that went on at the time. If people can look at, for example, the political spectrum today and realize the intense division, the polarization that exists within the political branches of left and right and all that, I say take that and like increase it with, I don't know, 1,000 and realize that people are out in the streets and killing each other, basically, right?
Sure. I mean, this had gone on after World War One back in Germany, but more so we'll find out that National Socialism and Communism are mortal enemies. They are mortal enemies. And when World War II, we'll find, does eventually take place, it isn't like a war with France or a war with England. It's a total annihilation. It's the wipeout of a culture, of a political system. And at the end of it all, that's exactly what happened to National Socialism.
So they're enemies of communism, and despite that, afterwards, hindsight, we've heard, I don't know how many documentaries I've seen about how Hitler wanted to create a new world order, right? He was the one who wanted to conquer the world and take over everything. It feels, again, we're in those situations where they've actually flipped the arguments, and what applies to one here actually applies to the other, correct?
Yeah, I mean, they do that quite often all the way through. Like, as I said about the myth of Germany needing a war to get the financial situation sorted, when all the time it was America what needed the war. There's numerous occasions I'm sure we'll come across where you'll flip the coin.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of that going on. It's very interesting. It's of course, it's a... Yeah, go ahead.
Can I just say at this point, people have got to remember that in 1933 when Roosevelt came to power, he was the one that brought in this triangle with the eye on the top of the back of the dollar. He was in with the bankers.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That was through, Henry Wallace. He had his guru there over in Tibet.
Oh, great. Sympathetic to communism.
Yeah, exactly. Nicholas Roerich, and it was actually a plot. Wallace was actually very communist-friendly, and they had an idea there of like trying to impose that type of internationalism that we see today in the world, pretty much, and consequently a new world order,
Exactly.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about, there's, again, obviously so many angles, there's so many tangents, there's so many interesting pieces, and folks, just keep in mind, we won't be able to cover everything here. I mean, obviously, we're here to talk about the film, and I want you to go and take a look at the film and then judge for yourself. Break it up into couple of parts. If you can't watch it all in one day, it's long, it's 6.5 hours, but it's well worth your time, people. If you are interested in reaching a level of truth, if you're interested in seeing the flip side of something that we've been told for over half a decade now, it's very, very important. But what happened here then when we look at the war? Like, we have the speeches, the ideas of Lebensraum. We have to have room for our people where we can live. There is a conflict that starts to occur towards the east in Poland, Czechoslovakia. What really happened here, Dennis?
Well, again, it comes down to this root point of communism, because by 1936, Spain was having a torrid time where communists were fighting a civil war in Spain, and nuns and priests were getting slaughtered, and Hitler actually sent his air force to help Franco defeat the communists. That's in 1936. So all this talk about room for okay, Germany of 80 million, maybe the country wasn't big enough, but the point was, all they were trying to do at this point was to defeat communism as it was in Spain, and then bring back under the umbrella of the Reich all the parts and places what he looked at as stolen from Germany after World War One. So as far as living space, he was looking at Austria, and he was looking at Czechoslovakia, and he was looking at parts of Poland, which he rightly knew belonged to Germany, previous to the Versailles Treaty.
That's right. We have the Anschluss before that, the joining with Austria. And was it Switzerland too, or just Austria?
No, it was just Austria, and that was another myth as well, because I was taught to believe, I'm not sure what the Americans over there were taught, but I was taught to believe that he invaded Austria, and it was another military takeover, when the documentary clearly shows it is a war of flowers, and the mass crowds what came out to greet him, and the 99.7% people what voted to join the Reich. So that, again, is another myth destroyed.
Yeah, that this was done by force, etc. Now, what about the regions here where when all this is occurring and happening, the tremendous build-up, and then you have, of course, the situation where Germans, you know, German-speaking people who are living in Poland and Czechoslovakia are basically attacked. We hear that the opposite is true, that Germany basically just invaded Poland, right? What happened there?
Well, this again is a great myth. Because of this breaking up of Germany after World War One, the parts of Germany, as you say, in Poland or in Czechoslovakia, where they weren't even allowed to speak their own language. There was a minority amongst people who didn't particularly like the Germans, and so the German minority suffered under it. And it got to a point where in Czechoslovakia, where minorities were getting attacked, and they demanded to join the Reich. And Hitler saw the problem and didn't think nothing about attempting to join them. But he did invite, people probably don't realize, he did invite the British and the French to come to the Munich Peace Treaty. It was his idea. He didn't want to use force. And obviously, the other Mussolini there as well, they knocked out an agreement. And as far as things went, Chamberlain went back to England more than happy with that piece of paper. As Hitler said in speeches since then, it was the people who were waiting back home who were against it. It wasn't Chamberlain. It was the people back home who was against it and started stirring for another war.
It's eerily similar, actually, to the situation we've seen in between Ukraine and Russia right now.
Very similar.
And look at how much confusion there is. I can't even, to be honest, begin to tell you what actually is happening there. I have a lot of questions about Ukraine because, of course, we can see who wants to control it. We see the influences of the Zionists there that we've seen for so many other satellite states, unfortunately, around Russia. There's a tremendous anti-Russian sentiment in the West right now, and it's like Russia is the new Germany almost, right?
Yeah, but more or less. And plus, you know, there was attempts on Hitler's life, which he believed to be part of this growth outside, and the same with Putin. I mean, some people are already talking about the fact that Putin's aeroplane was flying at the same time as the aeroplane what was brought down the other week.
Yeah.
And the newest leader from South America doesn't accept a genius to say that it's not, you know, it's more than possible, because Putin is upsetting a lot of people, especially the BRICS at the moment.
Well, exactly. We're going to take a break in a little bit here, and when we continue and talk more in the second hour, there's much more we need to tackle. We're basically just going to kind of continue in the timeline here a little bit, as we've been doing, and try to lead up to the war. But before we take a break here, let's just tackle the issue of the hatred against Jews. We have a lot of speeches where Hitler and others talk quite openly about what they call the Jewish problem and everything else. What was really going on here? Is there a way that you can detail to us, Dennis, of if Hitler hated all the Jews, and so why? There are other rumors, of course, about the things like the transfer agreement, that there was suggestions, and you cover this in the documentary as well, very well made in that regard, of how there was an agreement to try to get the Jewish population out of Germany, and then there was consequent situations where they were even given money and everything else. And what you show in the documentary is that at some point there he was stabbed in the back, basically. What happened there?
Well, again, this has been suppressed, and not a lot of people who watched the documentary knew about it. But yeah, what happened was the Zionists, after World War One, had done a deal with Great Britain with the Balfour Agreement, where they were given Palestine after they got America involved in World War One, another subject which people didn't realise. Once they got this, the Zionists then wanted Jews from around the world to go into Palestine and create what is today Israel. And at the time, it served the purpose of Hitler and National Socialist Germany, because he felt that the Jewish influence was totally against the culture of German society, where the art was different, the movies were more sexually explicit, homosexuality and such was always involved. So all this was decadence was against German culture of or tradition. So he made a deal with the Zionists. The Zionists needed Jews in Israel, and he made sure that all the Jews left Germany, moved to Palestine, and they set up a banking system where all the belongings would be transferred over into Palestine when they arrived. So this myth of Jews leaving Germany with nothing but not even a sack on the shoulder was blown apart with a transfer agreement. And this was going on right up to World War II starting in 1939, when other forces take over. But does this sound like an evil man?
Well, it sounds like there was a clear situation where we have an opposition, where there are conflicts based on cultural and religious and ideological differences, which it seems like they've reached a point where they said, okay, you know what, for us to be able to live in peace and not be able to just be at each other's throat all the time, to war with each other, to kill each other even, let's try to sort something out here where we basically don't have to war with each other, but we don't have to live next to each other and be at each other's throats. Would that be a fair assessment, do you think?
Well, yeah, that's true, but don't forget also that there's a lot of Jews have been in Germany for quite some time, so even friends of Adolf Hitler were Jewish.
Sure, yeah, that's true.
His driver was Jewish. Many of his army was Jewish, but they were happy with the culture of what Germany was, has and always has been. So that wasn't a problem, but the Jews who wanted to leave, and as you said, for their own religion, their own culture, that was an opportunity. Apart from the ones in Berlin who left on their own accord anyway.
And this is not something, I want people to understand this as well, this is not something that's actually really unusual, because if you look at this scenario, Dennis, objectively again, truthfully, we can see that there's a lot of places where the Jewish population have been expelled from in Europe for many, many years, actually, since the 1100s all the way up to 1800s. We've mentioned this number before, but over 1,200 different locations in Europe. This is kind of, think of that as you may will, everyone is listening to that, whatever, but what I'm getting at is that was just something that was common, I should say, right?
It's a terrible fact, because somebody once said to me once, it can't always be the landlord, what's the problem?
Right, well, exactly. Is it exactly how much are you just only going to continue to blame the European? Is there no reason for this? Is it just out of the blue, psychotic, European behavior, right?
Exactly. All those nations, what did it previous to Hitler, there must have been a reason.
Yeah, there's a lot to discuss. But one last thing on this. But did Hitler want to kill all these people, Gypsies, Jews, homosexuals, and everyone else that basically didn't agree, communists, everyone else that didn't agree with them? Did he want to murder all of those people, and did he want to build up a war machine that ultimately would burn all these people on fire, whatever,
As much as people looked into it, and as many forgeries what's appeared over the years, there's never been actually any such proof or written documentation of people or Hitler thinking that way. Certainly the camps were brought into, especially after the Reichstag fire, the communists were rounded up, enemies of the state were rounded up, people we thought were detrimental to the German culture, such as the Gypsies and some of the Jews, but many of the Jews were communists anyway, that gets confusing. So at the end of the day, has he done anything any different to what any other country would have done looking after their own nation?
Did he murder a lot of these people? Did they end up in jail? What happened to them?
Well, as far as I haven't found any evidence of any mass murders. Certainly, I can't deny something. Some mistreatment would have gone on. It would have been naive not to think so. But at the end of the day, these are communists who want to take over the country, and just like in any other prison in any other country, they'll be kept under lock and key.
Yeah, it's a defensive, strategical approach, basically. If you have a situation where you know that some people want to overthrow your country, and despite you saying, well, this is just my politics, whatever, leave me alone, buddy, it's a free speech, whatever, how long are you going to continue to allow that behavior until it poses a real threat towards your nation and your people? You have to, what I'm getting at is that you have to, and I'm not justifying everything, of course, but I'm just trying to say you have to be able to defend yourself in a situation like this. This is a warfare tactic, right?
Yeah, because a lot of these people were instigators, and certainly there would have been outside forces willing to help them overthrow the government. It's that simple, as goes on since then and even today.
Oh, especially today. That's a lot of corrosive forces in the world. And look at the state of the world as well. I want to remind people about that before we wrap things up here. Look at what after two world wars, after the immense fighting between the European peoples primarily, look at where we are. Look at what it has gotten us today. Look at where we are. Is this what we were fighting for? Is this the peaceful situation that we wanted to achieve in Europe when we're handing everything away and multiculturalism is destroying our heritage and our culture? Is this, people, what millions of people, if you want to look at it this way, were sacrificed for, you know?
Well, it's true. That is exactly what happened.
It's a horrible scenario, people, and it's war, you know, and that's what we're faced with here, and we're trying to just analyze this from a point of view where we actually are intellectually honest about it, as opposed to the fantasy and all the consequent blame and the intentional hatred put or imposed upon Germany from people who realize that we're actually trying to beat the international globalist elite New World Order, and this is how a nation that actually achieved to break out from it first for a while were treated. This is an example, if you will, people. But Dennis, let's talk about the documentary a little bit more here, tell people where they can go and see it. Tell us about, I think you have DVDs available as well. I was going to pick up a copy of that because I want to just have a hard copy because it's...
Yeah, I'll make sure you get one. No, don't worry about that.
Thank you.
Okay, the problem was that when I first started doing the documentary, we did it in 15-minute parts, which went up on YouTube, and I knew at any time that they could have been taken down. Luckily, lasted 24 parts, or 27. So it was enough time for people to view them, and a lot of people even hosted them around the web. So I was quite pleased about that, but eventually it was banned. It was taken down and banned. There are some versions still up on YouTube, but those were the early versions, which since then was upgraded for a bigger TV screen and some points revised. We have a website at The Greatest Story I Never Told.tv, where you can actually view the whole documentary for free. You don't have to be a member, because we don't actually sell the DVDs. It's all part of a package. If you want to be a member, then you're given the DVD. But there's no need. You can watch it. All episodes are there. And like I say, even on YouTube, some of the earlier episodes are still up there. But unfortunately, you know, it was banned, and it wasn't unexpected.
Yeah, exactly. It's on Vimeo, I think, all the parts still, and there's another cut version on YouTube, right?
No, it's been banned from Vimeo.
Oh, it has now? Okay. That's
and
a bummer.
Facebook.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Facebook, YouTube, Vimeo, doesn't leave many outlets. But then again, that only tells me, you know, only the truth is really banned.
It certainly is. Look at who owns YouTube, people. And again, if you want to find out who you're not allowed to criticize, you know, that's...
The thing is, people at the website, they got a T-shirt campaign going up as well. Now, for many people who think, you know, it might be ridiculous to print an Adolf Hitler T-shirt, personally, I think it's abhorrent to print a communist T-shirt. Apparently, communist T-shirts are allowed.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, how many millions do they not murder? And it's all fine. It's actually cool. It's hip to wear that, you know?
Exactly. You've got pictures of Che Guevara, et cetera.
Yep.
All that is fine.
Yep.
But an Adolf Hitler, inoffensive Adolf Hitler T-shirt, was banned again.
Yeah. Well, again, he's the most evil, demonic, satanic man ever lived. We know that now. Right? just how it is, right? Yeah. No, but, I mean... It's I want to try to encourage people to to be serious about this and to actually look at it and give it a fair chance and see what you think of it. The documentary is very well made. The soundtrack is fantastic, by the way. Great job on that, too. You even have a sister site that actually hosts that as well, correct?
Yeah, soundtrack, yeah. I mean, it is an emotional... I mean, people find it hard to believe it, we haven't seen the documentary, but people have actually cried. In fact, if I could just briefly tell you...
I know what you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, but I did a talk to a selected few behind closed doors a while back, and this young man came up to me and introduced his Austrian girlfriend to me.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently... all her life, she'd hated Adolf Hitler. She'd hated anything to do with the Nazis. She even hated being Austrian. She carried all this hatred and all this guilt around with her for all this time. And then she saw the documentary, and by the end of it, she was in tears. And she's a completely different woman today. Now she's a different, proud, talking, walking Austrian lady. That's just been the documentary.
Yeah. There has been a psychological warfare here, folks, in terms of segregation of the Germanic peoples and the consequent blame. And we'll talk about denazification a little bit later, too, and all that kind of tremendous stuff that was going on. But it's, please take a look at it, folks, and see what you think. The Greatest Story Never Told on TV. And thank you as well, by the way, for making it offer it for free so people can actually have an opportunity to watch it. That's great you could do that. Thank you.
Sure.
All right, we'll have the links up on our website. Please check it out. Check out the soundtrack as well. Really good soundtrack there. And see what you think. Okay, Dennis, we'll take a short break. We'll be right back. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to the first hour. We are going to continue this interview right after the break with much more questions about the film, about the history surrounding Adolf Hitler's life, Germany, and World War II. Please join us at redeyesmembers.com. A membership is just 15 euros for a 3-month subscription. We have longer ones available as well. We have programs on all kinds of topics going back to 2006, including films, videos, and additional commentary. We are an independent and ad-free radio program that comes to you 3 times per week, and we do that with your support. Upcoming, we have Jessica Andreasson, Josh Reeves, Björn Nordström, Daniel Updike, Gordon Kennedy, Kai Murrows, and of course, Program 2 with John Lash. Heads up on these shows. We'll be right back with Dennis Weiss to continue our thought-provoking discussion. Thank you for staying with us.